One, I thought tonight I would focus, since I'm in a book promotion mode, focus on summarizing and then opening up for discussion my latest book. So a couple of things I wanted, well, more than a couple, a few things I wanted to say about it, but I do want to restrict it to at most 20, 25 minutes. I often think when I hear people presenting new material or books being interviewed, the first thing I want to hear is, why should I care? Why is it relevant? Or why is it pertinent? And then I want to hear, why is it distinctive? I mean, maybe many books have been written on this before. So why, what's new about it? Why, if it is distinctive, why it is? And then, I don't know, maybe certain bells and whistles about anything provocative in it, anything that kind of catches attention. So I think on those, and I have an 8 or 9 exhibits I just want to show you after I say this or as I go. I think what the relevant and pertinent part, I think, is easy, because capitalism is under attack. Now, how much it's under attack, historically speaking, I don't know. I think I would classify it as bad as the 30s and maybe the 70s. So in the 1930s, it was tremendously under attack, and it was scapegoated for the Great Depression and other things. And fascism and communism were on the rise in that decade, if you remember. And know your history. Now, the 70s were pretty bad as well, with all the turmoil and all the terrible economic performance, but also blamed on, largely blamed on capitalism and the greed of oil companies. Remember all that stuff. So I think, and what I argue in the book is there's an animosity. I would date basically the last 2 decades, a return of great animosity toward capitalism and this kind of delusional belief that alternative systems might be preferable, including things like democratic socialism. So I don't think it's difficult to argue that a book on capitalism, especially one that defends it, is very pertinent and very relevant, and also odd in the sense that it's not that a lot of books on capitalism aren't being written. I do keep track of these, and there's one coming out every week. I mean, I think the publishers have realized if capitalism or capitalist is in the book title, it sells. But as I scan these books and peruse them, 98% of them are anti-capitalist. So that alone, I think, is an interesting kind of mystery. So that's one thing. I think also distinctiveness, I want to say something about the distinctiveness. Besides the fact that this is an avowedly pro-capitalist book, there are some other pro-capitalist books, historically. I think what's really distinctive about this one is it recognizes capitalism as more than economics. It's very common among even free market economists, they call themselves free market economists, that their focus mainly is on economics. And they're, in many ways, I think, perplexed as to why there'd be such animosity toward capitalism, because it produces the goods. I mean, even its critics say that. Marx said it as far ago as the Communist Manifesto. So it's a head scratcher for most free market economists that on the one hand, they think, wow, maybe people are against capitalism, because they don't know how supply demand works, or they don't know price theory, or they don't know what free trade, is mutually advantageous. And all the economic arguments in the world are not going to change people's view of capitalism if they characterize it as evil, if they characterize it as unjust, if they're discussing it on a moral level. So if that's the case, which I think is the case, they're going to say, who cares whether it's practical or not? It's immoral. And now you have to have a theory that says, people are largely motivated by ethics more than by economics, and possibly even more than by politics. What's distinctive about this book in terms of my take is, again, expanding it beyond just the economics of it, I take what's called a PP&E approach. And in academia, PP&E is a more interdisciplinary approach. And the PPE stands for philosophy, politics, and economics. So it's uniquely capable of handling capitalism and all its rivals precisely because these systems have those elements to them. It's not just an economic system, not just a political system, it's not just a philosophic system. So the book's structure, and I'll go through the table of contents quickly after this, you'll see, has almost equal weights of discussion on the philosophy of capitalism, meaning really the morals of it, the ethics of it, the justice of it, and the critiques of that, of course. And also there's politics in there, and also there's economics. So for the pure economist reading this, it will be new to them to hear the political ethical arguments. For the pure philosophers who are not comfortable with politics and economics, they'll get the politics and economics of capitalism. There are poli-sci majors out there who, very few of them are going to be pro-capitalist, but if they get a little economics and philosophy out of this, they would be benefited as well. So I think of it as like, you know, the standard three legs of a stool. If it's just one leg, it's not going to stand. If it's two, it's not going to stand. These three legs are not only the three, philosophy, politics, and economics, are not only going to enable people to understand capitalism better, but I would say for the advocates of capitalism, a much better foundation for defending capitalism. And I would actually put it to the critics that if you really want to be a critic of capitalism, you have to attack it on these three levels as well. It can't be attacked just on one level, we know, on economics. It's not vulnerable on that score, and the enemies know that. So in many ways, the enemies of capitalism are agreeing with my approach of having this three-pronged approach. Now, I do teach PP&E at Duke, so some of this, I think this book, I was pro-capitalist before I started teaching at Duke, but I would say that teaching at Duke in the PP&E program has enormously increased my understanding of capitalism. And there's a particular, I would say also, there's a particular seminar that I put together for freshmen, a very small seminar. Seminars mean no more than 20 students. And I've done this now 4 years in a row, and it's just very illuminating to give. It's called Capitalism For and Against. So it's a seminar where half the readings are defending capitalism from these three perspectives, and the other half of the readings are trashing capitalism from these three perspectives. So the students get that. Me teaching it repeatedly has enormously increased my understanding of this whole thing. So that's one point. Another point is, and I think now actually it's worth going through some of the slides. So that's just a summary slide at the top. If you go to the next one, Abby, this is actually right in the preface. I say right up front, this interrogative, where have all the capitalists gone? I use a play on words a little bit. If you ask a person what a socialist is, they'll say an advocate of socialism. But if you ask them what a capitalist is, they'll say, I don't know, a financier, a venture capitalist. They very rarely will say an advocate of capitalism. But that's how I'm using the word. I'm using the word as where have all the capitalists gone, not in the sense of where did all the bankers go, where did all the financiers go, but where did all the advocates of capitalism go? And I do recount in the book who they were, how they enabled the U.S. and others to win the Cold War, and how capitalism was actually advancing in the last two decades of the last century, namely 1980 to 2000, but it's been in retreat since. So that is really what it's examining. It's examining in a way, why, even though it has this wonderful economic record, it's in retreat, and what it would take to bring them back, actually. So now this particular passage is a summary. This is from the preface, and it says, I have my glasses here. My argument can be stated succinctly. Capitalism is the only legitimate habitat for humanity. It's, now get this now, it's sustainable because it's practical. It's practical because it's moral. It's moral because it's egoistic. And it's egoistic because it's rational, and humans are natural, I go on to say. Now, when you think of this link and this sequence, that's a long sequence of argument, but notice it includes philosophy, politics, the practical issues, as well as the moral issues. And I'm arguing here that no argument for capitalism can forget all these things. So go up a little more, Abby, and I'm going to elaborate on these, but first show you the structure of the book. These are a series of essays I wrote over the last decade. Half of them are over the last 5 years, so they're fairly new and fairly fresh, and they come from four or five different sources. Some were written at Forbes, some were written at the American Institute for Economic Research, some were written new for this book. The preface is certainly new for the book. Some of them were from my investment consulting firm and were only available to clients until now. But what I did is I went through, and there were clear themes. I haven't changed my views that much. I've just learned more over the last decade. So I thought I would start more philosophical. This first section is about the meaning of capitalism and the moral arguments pro and con on capitalism. This, and you see there's, you know, a half a dozen essays or more under that section. So it's structured logically, in a sense, not chronologically. In each case, the chapters and the essays, you get the original sources as to where they came from. Now, the second section has more to do with freedom and governance. So that would be classified, I think, as more politics than anything. So the first section is about ethics and morals. The second one's really about government and its role in a capitalist system. The next one is really about economics. So section three, called The Primacy of Production, if you look there, the essays and the entries are mostly about economics, but they start with the basics like Say's Law. There's stuff in there about Keynes versus Say's Law. In all cases, I'm giving the pros and cons as well and refuting them as well. Now, if you go to the next section, Abby, four, money and banking. Now, this is obviously economics, but it's one of my specialties. I was in the banking industry for the 80s and 90s. And so I'm very interested in, and I think it's highly topical, the way money and banking and central banking generally are going these days. They're really going off the rails. So the whole issue of money, sound money, the gold standard versus not, modern monetary theory, that's all in this section, including the Federal Reserve becoming really a reckless, ruleless set of rulers. The business cycle, obviously also economics. My forecasting firm does a lot with the business cycle, so I thought I would include some essays in there. Those are going to be more quantitative. Those are going to be more tips on how to forecast the business cycle, but also an argument that it's not markets left free that cause boom and bust, but rather governments that do. Now, the next one, if you notice, is a mix of economics and, I would say, politics. The fiscal state and its burden. Here you're going to get a lot of essays on taxes, and not just the economic effect of taxes, but the politics of it, the populism of it, the soak the rich type of stuff. What did we just have this past week? An argument about whether there should be a billionaire's tax. So I talk about the fairness or not of the tax code, whether a graduated income tax is unfair or not. I say it's unfair. I detail in here the burden on the producers and the wealthy, the unnecessary burden, and also basically the fiscal state out of control. We have a burgeoning welfare state where the funders of it do not want to tax people because they'll get thrown out of office. So one theme in this section is that there's a bias toward deficit spending. There's a bias toward chronically spending more than is taken in taxes. And of course, you have to borrow the difference. So the burgeoning debt, the Fed desire to monetize that debt, is all part of a piece in this particular section. Now, the next section is clearly back to morality, if you will. Justice and inequality, questions about whether capitalism is just or not, whether it's just for people to be rich or not, whether inequality is okay or not. I argue here that capitalism is essentially a system of unequal performance and unequal rewards. However, that's not a bad thing. The problem today is that there's a unwillingness to have equality before the law. There's a real erosion, I argue, in this section of constitutionally limited government and a throwing out of the idea that people should be treated equally before the law. My contention here is that people are unequal. They're not only unequal in their birth status, but they're unequal in the kind of professions they choose, in the work ethic they have. And so we think my view is it should be natural that people end up in different positions economically, but it doesn't mean they got there by robbing others, and we shouldn't be envious toward those who are more successful. Unfortunately, the welfare state and the entire tax code these days is geared exactly to codifying envy. All right, now the next section, I hope you see, by the way, by these sections that as you go through them, you're going to get a mix of philosophic, political, and economic arguments. Globalization and trade is obviously a hot topic. I don't have as many essays here because actually it was not a contended thing until Trump came along. So many of these are obviously defenses of free trade, critiques of protectionism, a defense of globalization, which just means global trade. There's a critique coming from both conservatives and nationalists and socialists against free trade. So I thought that was worth discussing, I come out with actually a very rare argument for unilateral free trade, which is the idea that you do not sit down and strike free trade agreements with other countries. You don't basically waste your time doing that. You just adopt free trade on your own, regardless of what others do. Now, this next one on crisis, the whole idea of things in crisis, is it caused by free markets or not? Does government fix those crises or cause them? That's what I examine here. And the three biggies, of course, in the last two decades are 9/11 and its aftermath, the financial crisis of 08, 09, and then more recently, this COVID stuff. Now, that my theme here is, in many cases, these crises are one, caused by a government, and then two, used as a pretext for more government controls and government takings of liberty. So a hot topic now, many essays in here on that issue. And I think the whole history of crises and emergency powers and decrees and things like that are, it's manifest that those are causing capitalism to be submerged. These are not crises caused by capitalism, but it's certainly the claim of the anti-capitalist that every time there's a crisis, somehow capitalism caused it. The next one, varieties of anti-capitalism. Here, I draw from work I've done at Duke about what I call the friends and foes of capitalism. And there are many foes. There are many enemies. And the essays basically deal with that. Why do they oppose capitalism? What are the reasons they give for opposing capitalism? So this is a section that basically highlights the idea of even for a pro-capitalist, you're going to face a gauntlet of opposition, and you need to know where it's coming from. But actually, I have to say the whole theme of the book really is you can't be defensive about it. Remember Donald Trump in his State of the Union said something like, the United States will never become a socialist country. And when I first heard that, I thought, well, that's a sentiment I share. But notice how defensive it was. We will not become socialist. Now, what is he reacting to? The squad and these others who are pushing socialism. What would it take for a president to say, I want America to become more pro, a more capitalist country. See, that's taking the offense and saying there's a case to be made for capitalism, not this defensiveness to be against anti-capitalism. If you advance it, Abby, I'm just going to go through a couple of exhibits that I've excerpted. There are, last time I counted, I think there's more than 60 exhibits. And so you'll get from this book some nice pictures and graphs that illustrate interesting relationships. So it's not just reading prose for 500 pages. It is a long book. It's 500 pages, but it's chock full of really good stuff. I thought I would just highlight some of these exhibits. They're actually a little more philosophical, so they're not going to be, you know, line charts of interest rates and things like that, although they're in there. But I'm going to highlight the ones that are more about capitalism. Now, here's an example of an exhibit taken very early on in the book. I think it says page 34 there. Now, if you look on the left and then on the right, I'm basically saying these are the pillars of the two systems. And notice at the very bottom, if you start with capitalism, it says reason. Then going up from there, it says egoism. Then going up further, individualism, private ownership, rights, and constitutionalism. So the bottom issues are like philosophical. What's the role of reason and the mind in the system? And then the ethic of, are you pursuing self-interest or something else? Is it an individualist type system or not? And to me, that all leads to, well, that's why there would be private ownership. Private ownership is a very individualist thing. The whole idea of rights to life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness, a very American, a very capitalistic thing. Constitutionalism, the idea that government can't do just whatever it wants, but must be restricted by a constitution. Now, on every score in this essay, this is just an exhibit from an essay, statism has the opposite focus. It's not based on reason, but on feelings and subjectivity. It's not calling for individualism and egoism, but rather sacrifice yourself for the collective, sacrifice for yourself for the group. Don't think of yourself, think of the general interest instead. And of course, public ownership or control of the means of production, even the leftists and some of the fascists will say, yes, that's exactly what we demand. And you're duty bound to do that. And the government's going to be authoritarian, not constitutionally limited. So this is the kind of knowledge I'm trying to give the reader so they get a better sense of capitalism versus its opposites. Now, statism is a broader term. It's the idea that the state is all important and there can be types of statism. So let's go to the next level and I'll show you that. This matrix I use at Duke and elsewhere has been very helpful. What is statism? It's well recognized by all parts of the spectrum. If you ask a socialist, what is socialism? And the terminology is very confused today. So I think this is illuminating. The socialist will say, my system is public ownership of the means of production. What does that mean? It means the government owns factories, equipment, tools, resources, things like that. And there's also this issue of control, if you think about it. You might own something in title, but if others get to tell you what to do with that thing, if they control the means by which you use it, you don't really have full control of your property. So what I've done here with this matrix is I've said, let's look at ownership and control together. And capitalism, and again, the enemies of capitalism would pretty much admit this. Capitalism is a system where the means of production are both owned and controlled privately. Again, it's not like there's no government, but the government is not telling you what to do with your property. You own your property and you decide what to do with it. Now, in the footnote below, I say, let's go beyond just talking about the means of production. Let's also talk about the products of production. So it's not just factories and equipment and things like that, but personal effects, your car, your laptop, your toothbrush, those things are going to be privately owned and privately controlled under capitalism. Now, the complete opposite, if you go to the other diagonal, in the southeast quadrant, if you will, socialism is not only public ownership, but public control of the means of production. And again, the socialists will admit that. Now, fascism, I think, is actually the direction that the West is going. This is a controversial term. Everyone thinks of Hitler and Mussolini when they hear fascism, as they should. But notice where I put fascism. It's private ownership, right? It's in that quadrant, but public control. So the fascists, if you look at the fascist history, and they'll admit this, they never nationalized anything. That they didn't take over industries and factories and companies. They let them remain free, but they told them what to do. They micromanaged everything they did. It was a heavy regulatory state. And their feeling, of course, was if we own the thing, they'll run it into the ground like the socialists do. So we don't want to do that. But on the other hand, we want to use it for statist purposes. So one feature of fascism is not only that, the heavy regulatory control of private industry, but also they do promote big business. So this is very confusing to people because it sounds capitalist. The reason they promote big business under fascism is it's easier to control big, fewer businesses than to control a plethora of smaller businesses. So that the whole, what they call the corporatist model, the corporatist state, the quote partnership between government and business, which is very common in fascism, should not be seen as a version of capitalism. It's a version of statism. So that's something to look for when you see someone like Obama or Bernie Sanders. They'll say, I'm not a socialist because I'm not trying to nationalize everything. Yeah, but if you look at all the things they're trying to regulate, they're actually more accurately characterized as fascist. And that's a terrible system. I won't talk about feudalism right now because that's not as relevant, but that's in the fourth category. Okay, so move up, Abby, to the next. Here's another exhibit that really goes to the title of the book. When I remember, I said, where have all the capitalists gone? And I said, we need to think of capitalists as advocates of. This exhibit might be difficult to see, but it takes up a full page in the book. Here I recount a very interesting 40, 50-year period. That's all it was. It was an amazing 40 or 50-year period, basically starting at the end of World War II and ending with the end of the Soviet Union. And what I've given you here is basically the famous, most influential capitalists in the sense of advocates of capitalism. And if you look, they range from economists to political theorists to philosophers to novelists. And the big names, of course, you might not know the early names like Snyder, but Snyder was very good. Capitalism, the Creator, he wrote, 1940, fabulous book. Hayek is in here, The Road to Serfdom. Mises is in here, Human Action. These names will be familiar to some of you, but this is just the library of pro-capitalist arguments that any pro-capitalist really should master. Hazlitt's in here, Economics in One Lesson. Ayn Rand is in here, The Fountainhead, Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal. Schumpeter's in here, great champion of the entrepreneur, capitalism, and profit seeking. Notice Mises, The Anti-Capitalist Mentality. Hazlitt's critiques of Keynes, which were fabulous. Capitalism and the Unknown Ideal came in the 60s. Anarchy, State, and Utopia. Nozick was really important because he was a Harvard professor. It was unknown in Harvard and elsewhere that there would be anyone who would stand up for the free society. And Nozick did, and that was huge. Now, supply-side movement as well, as I tip my hat to here. Now, what is it leading to? It led to people like Thatcher, Reagan, Mulroney in Canada, winning election in the 80s and changing policy away from Keynesian interventionism towards supply-side pro-entrepreneur capitalists, not pure capitalism, but in that direction, moving in that direction. And the famous fall of the Soviet Union, I mean, absolutely unpredicted by anybody, including some on the right. Some on the right even thought that they were monolithic. But it's just a great period and shows how improved the world can get when people are pro-capitalist. Now, the real mystery that I addressed in the book is, where are all these capitalists? The one simple answer would be they're in their graves. They're all gone. But why didn't they produce students? Well, I'm a student in a way. I'm a student. Many of us are students of these great thinkers. But we really, I use we, the royal we, a little loosely here, we really have not carried the torch or taken the baton from these and advanced the argument. And that's a mystery, and that's something that's worth discussing and analyzing, because otherwise we're going to lose this system and lose this great country. But my bottom line answer, not to give away the plot, I'll give away the plot a little bit, it's that the moral argument has to be emphasized. The morals of capitalism, the rational egoism of capitalism has to be more forthrightly defended. The individualism of it, those pillars I was talking about before, that is really what's making people cringe. That's really what's making people reticent. They're really reluctant to go there. And as a result, they're being steamrolled by the moral certainty of these others who are claiming to have the moral high ground. They don't have the moral high ground, but the advocates of capitalism sadly say don't quite know that yet. One more, Abby. I think there's one more, or that might be the end of it. Let me check. Is that okay? Let me skip over that one. That's a little too detailed. Now, this one's a little too detailed, so I'm not going to go through all of it, but this is the last exhibit in the book, and it's taken from my seminar, and this is the kind of condensation that you'll really enjoy from the book. What this is the friends and foes of capitalism organized by the three big questions, and we take an entire semester to go through this with the students. But by the end of it, they're able to fill in these little thumbnail sketches. But notice up top what I'm asking of each set of ideas. What do they define capitalism to be? Do they think it's moral? Do they think it's practical? Do they think it's sustainable? And notice what I have. I have the Marxists, then I have Keynesians, then I have conservatives, libertarians, objectivists, environmentalists, feminists. We go through their writings, we go through their arguments, and it's really fascinating to see it quite this way, because they all have very definitive views on these three questions. And I think it's an enormously valuable way to summarize, you know, who the friends and foes are. And you can see from this that even the friends might have very weak arguments. As just one example, Schumpeter, I said, is very good. Schumpeter's great about capitalism is wonderful. Capitalism is dynamic. It's the entrepreneurial system. We should have liberalism in the good sense of liberty. We should have limited government. But guess what Schumpeter's actual view on capitalism's sustainability was? He said it wasn't sustainable. Why? Because the intellectuals will come to hate it. So it's a different view than the Marxist view. The Marxist view was capitalism will burst apart, it'll so exploit labor that labor will rise up and overthrow capitalism. Well, that hasn't happened, but obviously Marx is not in the camp of people saying capitalism is sustainable. But some of capitalism's friends don't even think it's sustainable. And that's not a very good argument. If capitalism isn't sustainable, what's the point of defending it on any grounds, moral, practical, or economic? I know some libertarian friends, by the way, who will say something like this. capitalism is great, but here's what happens. The wealthier capitalists get, they just can't stop themselves from bribing politicians. So what is the big word in Austrian economics and public choice economics? Rent seeking. What's rent seeking? Corporations bribing politicians for special favors. So see, these libertarians think that's inevitable. They think it's unavoidable. And they'll say crony capitalism comes out of free market capitalism. See, that's not my view. That's not really Ayn Rand's view. Our view is if you get a mixed economy, if you throw away constitutional limits on government, if you allow politics to bleed into economics, you're going to get corruption. You're going to get the kind of bribery and extortion we see, but it's just as much extortion on the part of politicians extorting things from the private sector as it is the private sector seeking favors. So the solution to something like that, to make capitalism truly sustainable, you have to fight for constitutionally limited government. That's what's going to stop the corruption. That's going to stop the issue of the money affecting politics. I have an essay in here right to this point. It goes something like this. The title was, "To Get Money Out of Politics, Get Politics Out of Money Making." See the idea that you only have money in politics because politics is so involved in money making, redistributing that wealth, making people want to care about who's in office versus not. So I think I'll stop there. That's a basic summary of the entire theme of the book, really, more than anything, and be glad to take comments or questions from here.
All right, well, we have a couple comments and questions in the chat, and then after that, do you want me to, first of all, should I get rid of the screen share so we can see everybody's face?
Sure. Or
do you want to keep anything?
That'd be great. Yeah, thanks, Abby.
Yeah, let me get this right here. Got this, and I have a few quotes from the preface here and things like that. But so the first question I see in here that was just, where did it go? Should we think of politics and economics as necessarily separate? So that was from Jake, and I don't know if he has anything he'd like to elaborate on that as a question, but you guys can feel free to unmute your mics, unmute your cameras, and ask these questions as well yourselves.
That's a good question. Is that Jake? That's a good question, Jake. Yeah, I do think it's worth,
I think, just being even more specific is like throughout history, the way people make money is pretty inherently tied to the political system, either the governing system or more blatant politics.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So how should we separate them?
I think conceptually politics is what I call public governance, not private governance. So we think of government as politics, but the broader concept, and there's some essays in the book on this, if we think of governance generally, we have political governance, but we also govern our lives with, you know, personal rules of operation and things like that, how often we brush our teeth in the morning. And so the distinction is politics really is about force. The state, I mean, all sides will say the state is that institution with a monopoly over the legitimate use of force. Markets are not that. Markets are voluntary, and economics generally, voluntary exchange between people for mutual advantage. And so there's a big difference between economic power and political power. The two are totally blended together, if you notice, by anti-capitalists. The anti-capitalists will say, you know, Exxon has such power that it's no different than a dictator. And so we need democracy in the workplace and we need government control. I reject that view. But the relationship between the two, Jake, really crucial, because the libertarian view would be, since the government is what I just said it was, it has this monopoly over the use of force, it's always going to do evil things. And so government, they say, is a necessary evil, and therefore get rid of it if you can, be an anarchist. But, you know, my view is government is a necessary good. If it's properly behaved, if it's properly restricted, it's absolutely indispensable to free markets. You're just not going to get trade in an anarchist setting or in an autocratic setting. So that's just part of the answer. It's much more than that, Jake. But I think the big challenge is people do not think there can be a bright line between politics and economics. They're convinced that the two must blend together, and then they just fight over to what extent the government controls markets. I have found, by the way, that it's very difficult to get over the contention that capitalism is just government run by capitalists. That is a very common view. In fact, the name capitalism itself makes people think, oh, that's the system of, by, and for capitalists. The opening essay in my book actually says capitalism is a great name for this system because its Latin root is actually head, cap, head. It's a system of the mind. It's a system that most protects the human mind and creativity. Good question, though, Jake. There's way more to say than just that.
I think Dr. Kelly's up next. You guys can raise your hands with that feature. I believe that's what he did. There's a feature. It'll pop you up next if you have something pressing. So Dr. Kelly, if you want to ask your question.
Yes. Thanks, Richard. I have your book, and I was looking at the exhibits as you were talking, and I realized there are buried riches here that I haven't fully mined yet. So thank you for that. A question. Objectivists have been fighting against altruism for many years, trying to point out that it's not dog eat dog, it's not, you know, screw your buddy. It is a productive pursuit of self-interest. And economists have the idea of, you know, that people act in their self-interest. But the altruism seems inescapable in the view, in the popular attitude that business people are amoral at best, but government is good because they have no, you know, profit motive. And that, and so I guess my question is, to what extent do you think the drift away from capitalism is driven by the moral basis, the moral antipathy, or economic ignorance? And as a side point, you mentioned that in the last decades of the 20th century, things were looking good. They were moving in the positive direction. Now they're not. What changed on this issue of altruism versus economic ignorance? Thanks.
That's a really good question. I think in the period that I detailed, you know, 1940 to the end of the Cold War, I think the impetus was largely the moral arguments. Rand was not the only one. As we know, Hazlitt, Hayek, Friedman, I didn't even mention Milton Friedman, they were all trying to say as well that capitalism is moral and just. Friedman's whole free to choose thing. So their view was more like it's a moral system because you're free, but they would go so far as Ayn Rand and say, no, it's a moral system because it's rational egoism. It's hard for me to, I have some suggestions in the book, but it's hard for me to give a definitive answer as to why things turn at the end of the century. But the Soviet Union dissolved in 91. So the 90s themselves, I thought, were a great decade. It was a decade when you found Clinton and the Democrats, and even in Britain, Tony Blair and others, they were starting to mimic Thatcherism and Reaganism. They really weren't overthrowing it. And that's a sure sign that you're going in the right direction when you get the other party doing Me Too on your programs. I hate to attribute it to one event, but I think 9/11 really did, and here it is right at the turn of the century, right? 9/11 did make people turn to the government in ways that were, I thought, shocking. The Patriot Act, the buildup of national military stuff, the adventures abroad, which were so disastrous that we've seen in Afghanistan and elsewhere. There was no sense that that was a government failure, you know, and that wasn't, how could you say 9/11 was a failure of capitalism? But then by the time we get to the financial crisis of 08 and 09, to this day, that is still attributed to capitalism, which is ridiculous. It was a national government policy, you know, to artificially promote home ownership to people who couldn't afford homes. Duh, you know, who could have not have guessed that that would collapse? But it's remarkable how the lasting power of this idea that capitalism, although succeeding on practical terms, is still immoral. And there are themes in the book where I say, where I speculate, David, that the more capitalism becomes practically successful, there's kind of like a building animus toward it, because they're saying to themselves, wow, this is really unchecked greed. And so it's what they do is they don't say, well, I'm anti-capitalist because it's in depression. That was like the 1930s approach, right? The approach in the 90s was it's so dynamic and so prosperous spreading, it's got to be really, really evil. This is completely unrestrained egoism. So I'm not sure that's a very good answer, but it's undeniable to me that the last two decades are much more easily classified as the pro-capitalists on the defensive, and oddly enough, now on the defensive even economically. You know, it begins with, I don't think it's really moral, I don't know how to defend it. And then as the catastrophes come, they're not even sure how to defend the economics of it. They start worrying that maybe even the economics of it don't work out rightly.
Thank you, Richard.
Is there anybody else? Does anybody else have one?
Yeah. Can you guys hear me?
Yep, Steve.
No, this is David.
Or David down there. Sorry,
It's David with the M. But so David. It's a great presentation. I like the stuff you say.
Thanks.
I want to add, you know, because I just want to say, when you say where have all the capitalists gone, I think we need to define which capitalists we're talking about, okay?
Yeah.
And so, you know, because you can talk about big business versus small business. You talk about people that want to do businesses with many employees, small number of employees, people that want to be capitalists with no employees. You hear that all the time. You know, and I hear... you know, they don't want employees because they don't want the liability. They don't want a brick and mortar. They don't want the liability. Yeah. It's hard to say capitalism is lost when almost every TV show is based on how much money you can win. Okay. I mean, there's people out there that want to make money, but what they don't want is, you know, capitalism has that thing of risk and reward. And today, when people saw all the small businesses that were destroyed, okay, during the 2008, all the small businesses that were destroyed during this COVID bullshit, you know, it's like, and then when you hear about the tax thing, the only thing you hear about taxes, special taxes for businesses with more than 100 employees. I mean, all this is creating a sense of mind that I don't think it's destroying capitalism. I think it's destroying a huge sector of capitalism, which is the sector that we know has always made a difference in the world. And small business is where it's always been.
Well, this is it's a good question, a good comment, David. This is why I think my theme in the book is both unique and illuminating. This is totally, what you just described, which I agree with, the phenomenon, is totally consistent with the trend toward fascism. Although the populist talk is, you know, we're for small business and we're against these big bad tech giants and big business, bigness being badness, it's a total cover for their real goal. They don't care if small businesses run out of business. They're fascists, and fascists would prefer to have big companies lining their pockets and then in turn telling them what to do. It's the whole, if you know Davos, that's the best way to capture it. It's the whole Davos crowd, the ones that go over to the World Economic Forum every year and talk to each other. It's not just business people, of course, it's business and academics and think tanks and politicians. But what is the focus? The total focus is on big business and partnerships with government. The idea of the stakeholder model. There's a whole essay I have, by the way, totally refuting and tearing to pieces the stakeholder model. But what is the stakeholder model? Think of it, is throwing off the shareholder model where the owners of the company decide, and the big companies, right? The big shareholder companies, what to do with their property. God, these fascists hate that. They don't want shareholders being the sole deciders. They want stakeholders, meaning a broadly defined group of people that tell companies what to do. That's what fascism is. And stakeholders to them, well, it's not just the owners, it's the employees, and it's the suppliers, and it's the local politicians, and it's the tax base. Some of them will include in there the planet. The planet is a stakeholder. The earth has something to say on the board at Exxon. So So, David, I hear what you're saying, and I despair at the idea that the way these guys are getting away with it is by pitting big business versus small business, because they're not really anti-big business. They want big business in their pocket. They want to control big business. All the guilt trips, all the battering of them, like Obama used to say, those fat cats. Well, those same fat cats are the one that Senator Obama approved the bank bailouts. Obama approved the bank bailouts. Why? He's a fascist. He's not really actually a socialist. And so they play this game, this rhetoric game against bigness, and they're not really against bigness. They certainly are against smallness, although they say another. They would rather, yes, have the small business wiped out, because they can't control small business. You know, small businesses, it's too cumbersome for them to, you know, call up and say, do this and that for me. With thousands of small little businesses, they don't give a damn about
small. And yeah, the interesting thing is, Rich, is that without small businesses, you lose the innovation.
Yes.
I mean, Microsoft and Apple started in freaking garages.
Right.
The computer didn't come from IBM, which had been around for years and was huge.
Okay? Right.
So we all know, I mean, I love what you're talking about, fascism versus communism, because I have that discussion all the time with people, because people don't understand when I tell them that communism is more honest than fascism. Because communism to me is the guy with the gun that walks up to you, and I don't care about, I mean, the robber is honest. He's a thief. He tells me he's a thief when he puts the gun to my head.
Yeah.
The fascist is the guy that wants to tell you he's your friend, but you got to do it his way and this, that, and the other thing, and basically he controls your business.
And notice the other thing we're dealing with is, if you have this conception that capitalism is the system that favors capitalists, you're likely to look at fascism and say, well, that's just the way it is. That's capitalism. And I hate it. And I hate it. And I hate big business. But then if you look and you say, well, don't you realize that what we're moving toward is not really breaking up big business. They're not doing that at all. They're favoring big business and then hoping to control big business. That's exactly what's happening. And it's odd, because when the American people look at that, they say, yeah, that's what I hate, but I can't seem to stop it. This is supposed to be a heavily democratic system. No, we're way past the constitutional government, right? We're in a post-constitutional era. So even the conservatives who say, wow, we need to get back to the Constitution, these people do not give a damn about the Constitution.
Yeah.
They haven't since Woodrow Wilson. They simply want to bolster and get favors from big business. And then the rhetoric is against big business, but they just want to control them. That's my view. But so, I mean, there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. And it's actually very tragic, because the issue is not, Ayn Rand used to say this. She used to say, you know, the labor unions would pit themselves against big business. And she would say, you two are fighting each other and you have no clue you're on each other's side. And what's really driving you apart is the statists. They're the ones who are trying to instigate some antagonism between you two. Once you figure this out, the game is up. That was largely what happened in the 80s and 90s. I mean, the unions voted for Reagan. The Teamsters voted for Reagan. They voted for two landslides for Reagan. It's hard to believe, actually. And I would say the same thing now. These big business versus small business stuff is so much sleight of hand, you know, diverting attention away from the real problem, which is statism.
Yeah.
I think a lot of what we're talking about here is semantics of what the word sounds like to people and their immediate reaction. I think the term free market really attracts people. They like that. The term fascism, everybody hates fascists. That's a term that is automatically labeling as evil. I think the term individualism is good, and people say, yes, I'm an individual, and they identify with that. I think the term altruism is one people never hear. But this is what we're up against in communicating with the public. And I think if we can use the term free market a lot, that'll help.
I disagree with that, Robert. That's been tried. The conservatives have tried that for at least 5 or 6 decades now. They'll use free enterprise. They'll say free market. These opponents hate freedom. So they're not moved at all. I know you might think Americans are, but even Americans are moving away from that idea. I agree with you that capitalism, as I just myself admitted, seems the word itself to most Americans seems like, well, that's just favoring capitalists. So to that extent, they're correct. If it truly was a system that favored capitalism, capitalists, I would be against it as well. That's not what the system is. But I don't think you can get out of this by saying, let's change the rhetoric and fool people into loving capitalism. I think we should go with the word capitalism and defend it heartily. I think similarly, Ayn Rand said the same thing about selfishness. She was criticized for using that word, thinking, God, you're going to lose everybody who already thinks selfishness is terrible. But she had the same attitude toward capitalism. These words are real, they're worth defending. And if it takes a little argument to tell people that they have a false dichotomy going on, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But the other methods that you're suggesting sound defensive. They really do seem to be defensive. And that's what I want to get away from. There are at least 6 or 7 essays in the book criticizing conservatives. I mean, it's not just anti-left wing. The essay is saying the foes of capitalism include some conservatives who, either for religious reasons or ethical reasons, don't like capitalism. So that does not help. Often, and frankly, some libertarians as well, to the extent they embrace anarchy. So it's even difficult on the right to get a unified front defending capitalism. There are many libertarians I quote in the book saying, don't use the word capitalism. Stay away from it.
You know, let me just say, addressing Robert, you know, one of the things is that I think that a lot of people hate fascism for the wrong reason. I guess most people, when they think of fascism, they think of racism. They don't think of the evils of fascism when it comes to economics. And so when I know many of us talk about the word fascism, we're referring to the economics of fascism as opposed to the distraction of the people that want to say it's racist and whatever. I just think it's evil. But in the comments, I put in 3 videos, and I just want to promote that. The last video, and I think it did it reverse, but the video with Bill Whittle, when he did this speech on Romney, and he actually started out, this was done in 2012, and he said, here's what Romney should have said. And it's really a promotion of capitalism. And if people have a chance, it's a 15-minute video, but it's really a good speech, because he starts out with somebody saying that he was worth $200 million. And he says, you know, you made a mistake. I'm worth $250 million. And here's why the extra $50 million is so important. And you know, his comment is the problem with many capitalists is that we don't like what Richard's saying, we don't fight for it. And I think that anyway, if you guys get a chance, I think that all of you would enjoy the 3 videos.
One of the things I say in the book is not only are capitalists rare in the sense of advocates of capitalism, but capitalists who are financial capitalists and ideological capitalists, rarer still. That is very rare. So someone like George Soros is what? A financial capitalist, but an anti-capitalist ideologically. That's a much more common combination. I mean, most of the guys at senior level and gals at Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citicorp, I know them. I've worked with them for years. They're anti-capitalist. They're avowedly anti-capitalist. They give money to Obama, give money to Sanders. Most people don't realize it. They think, and this is a Marxist premise, they think rich people are pro-capitalist ideologically. They're not. Why? Because they go to the same elite public schools that are anti-capitalist. They can't avoid it. Even when they go to the business schools, if they go to Harvard Business School or Fuqua, they're going to get the same kind of stakeholder stuff. And so the whole movement toward woke capitalism, which surprises the hell out of people, surprises conservatives. Conservatives are thinking, wait a minute, what happened to the CEO suites? over the last two decades. Why are these CEOs signing on to all sorts of socialist and fascist measures? Because they don't escape the universities any better than anybody else does. And they're actually, if anything, kind of more shy about it, because they're overwhelmed by academics. They're kind of impressed by the eggheads and the IQ levels of people in academia. So if the academics are telling them, you're guilty, you're a parasite, turn over your corporations to something, by the way, the Marxists could not get on their own. They were supposed to take over the corporations violently, right? They couldn't do it. They didn't do it. Labor didn't want to do it. So what are they doing? They're bleeding them dry, jab by jab with this stakeholder stuff. Someone did a study of what stakeholders actually meant. There was a business school professor. She went through the literature just looking for what it meant to be a stakeholder. She counted 435 different types of groups and or people who called themselves stakeholders. That's how many people want to show up in the boardroom telling business what to do. I couldn't help but thinking 435 is also the number of representatives in the House. House of Representatives, the same number. So, by the way, Robert, fascism, you said it does have a bad name. It does. And so I'm a bit surprised why people don't more on the right who are pro-capitalist bring to the attention that that's the system we're moving toward. Instead, people think we're moving towards socialism. And notice what they do with the rhetoric there. They put the word Democrat in front of it. So they call it democratic socialism. And I'll often say to students, why are they modifying it? What is it about socialism that when it's not democratic, it's just brutal? It's inhumane. There's blood running in the streets. And you think it'll change if we vote for it instead of get it by violence, by ballots instead of bullets. So that's maybe part of our problem as well. Democracy is seen as saintly. Anything that's democratic, anything people vote for is seen as, well, that's fine. They voted for it. Well, they also voted for Chavez in Venezuela. They voted for Maduro. They have voted for those jackasses down in Caracas for decades now. Now, maybe some of the more recent elections were fraudulent and corrupt. But that always happens when you start with socialists. They win the first few elections, and then they overthrow the Constitution, and then they corrupt all subsequent elections. So this shouldn't be a big mystery to anybody, including the people of Venezuela. They voted for Hitler. They voted for democracy is not an assurance that you'll get liberty at all. If the democracy means just demos, demos means people. Democracy is ruled by people. If the people are complete ignoramuses or actually vicious, they'll vote for tyrants. I don't have to tell this audience that, but that's true. But notice AOC and others, they have no problem saying, I'm a Democrat socialist. And everyone thinks that whitewashes it, that democracy, the saintly thing, whitewashes the tyranny, which is the socialism. I'll often say to students, you have any problem with democratic fascism? Oh, of course. They go, what? Democratic fascism? What is that? I said, I don't know, that kind of fascism that the Germans practiced when they voted for the Nazis? That was democratic fascism. The students have no clue of that combination.
I think we should keep pointing out that the Nazis were national socialists.
Right. And I have a couple essays in the book, reluctant to be critical of Trump because everyone was critical of Trump. But there are a couple of essays, three or four essays in the book that point out, Robert, that on the one side, AOC and others, you get socialism, right? But from the Trump side, you get nationalism. It is identical to what happened in Weimar Germany and pre-Hitler Germany. You had nationalists on one side and socialists on the other. And you're absolutely right. Hitler and the Nazis came along and said, you're both right. Let's combine nationalism and socialism together. And that is what the contraction Nazism means. It means national socialism. So it's funny because the left hated Trump because he was a nationalist, but they're the socialists. So they're just providing the other side of the combination. But they were worrying that he would be a tyrant, that he would be the next Mussolini, never admitting that they were offering the socialist side of the wedding.
Professor, you talk about how, for example, United States or another country could unequivocally be free market or promote free markets and therefore not engage in any actual rules-based trading and not establish any trading relationship with any nation, just kind of forthright be free market as much as they can be. How, like, I'm having a hard time, like, rationalizing that if you have other nations, if you don't really have like a base understanding of free markets across the world, and the fact that you deal with other nations who are thinking in a geopolitical fashion, such as China. So could you talk more about this, and how could like one nation go about doing that without hurting themselves and shooting themselves in the foot in the short term? Because, like, could you go and do that and then be a leader, and would others follow? Because I think like the United States and the West kind of try that with China, and opening China up economically kind of just led to more authoritarianism.
So I do endorse what's called unilateral free trade, which is you just lower your tariffs and lower your barriers to other nations and basically adopt a free trade policy without negotiating with them, without sitting down. And if you know how these negotiations go, bilateral versus unilateral, two countries sit down. These things go on for years and months, and then special interest groups get involved, and the whole free trade agreement turns out to be a semi-free trade agreement. It's even worse with what's called multilateral negotiations. That's like 16, 17, 20 countries in the room. Those things go on for years, and they invite cronyism and they invite favoritism. So one of the reasons I advocate unilateral free trade is it just foregoes this opportunity to invite in corruption. That's point one. But point two is, listen, if Japan says we're going to put tariffs on U.S. goods, that they're taxing their own citizens. Why do we care? Why would you turn around and say, as Trump did, well, we're going to slap tariffs on you? Tariffs are not put on Japan. They're put on American importers. So when Trump said, I'm going to raise tariffs, he was basically saying, I'm going to tax the American people. But he would lie and he would say, China is paying these tariffs. China does not pay the tariffs. Tariffs are paid by your own citizens when they import stuff. So what I'm saying is, don't do that. Even if the other countries adopt tariffs, so what? They're taxing their own citizens. That doesn't mean we should tax our citizens. Now, here's another example. Suppose someone says, the foreign country is subsidizing exports. It's taxing its own citizens and pouring money into some country that sends us stuff for cheap. Why would you oppose that? It's like a gift. Again, you're not taxing yourself. Some other country's taxing its citizens to give you cheaper stuff. I don't know why anyone would oppose that, why anyone would put up barriers. So that's another argument for unilateral free trade. There are other reasons to do this. But I would say this, just because you brought up China, I think it's a good point to bring up. Something a government and any free society has to do is they do have to designate, if necessary, other countries as enemies. If you the State Department has to do this, or the Department of Defense. I'm not against Iran, for example, would be a good example of this. Iran is an obvious example. I'm not sure China is. So let's just take Iran as an example. I think it's perfectly appropriate for the U.S. State Department to say, Iran is an enemy of the United States. They want to kill us. They want to kill Israel. They're an enemy. And therefore, no trade. No trade with them. Disallowed. It's no different than a municipality saying, these are criminals. They're in jail. You can't trade with criminals. That, I think, is okay. But you still have to have objective definitions of what it means to be an enemy state. But there, I think you're perfectly appropriate. But that's not, when you think about it, that's not really a protectionist policy. It's a policy of saying they're enemies, therefore don't aid and abet enemies. And there, I think a government is perfectly legitimate to say to a company, you can't be selling stuff to Iran. Why? Because they're an enemy of the United States. And they might come out of that position, right? They might change their government in Iran, in which case you reassess the situation. But people forget that when the Soviet Union came into existence in 1917, the U.S. did not recognize that government for 16 years. And not until 1933, I don't think it should have recognized them even then. But notice the principle was practiced then, namely, okay, here's this new regime. Are they an enemy or not? If they're an enemy, we don't recognize them officially. We don't have ambassadors. We don't have trade with them. That I do think is appropriate. I wouldn't classify China in there. I know we differ on this. We've talked about this before. I would not classify China right now as an enemy of the United States. There's certain nefarious things they do, but I wouldn't classify them as an enemy, and therefore I wouldn't have a trade war with them. As Trump had. I mean, Trump started a trade war with them. I actually think, this will sound crazy, I know, I think China purposely sent the virus here to get Trump out. And then they counted on the left wanting Trump out as well. That's why the left is covering up China's role. I don't think it was an accident that it
Well, the virus is way too convenient. Why is it, the virus is way too convenient, let's be honest.
Well, that's a thing we can dispute, but... So Trump said, don't send us your gadgets and your Yahweh and everything. And they said, good, well, how about a virus? Maybe we'll send you that. See what happens. Anyway.
Or at least if they released it, they really made an effort to make it as damaging as possible for the rest of the world.
Steve, do you have your hand out?
Yeah. Great discussion, Richard. Talking about, you know, the anti-capitalist movement over the last 20 years, to what extent do you think some of that is attributed to the growth of cultural Marxism in the United States? Like, for example, I think it really, the roots of Marxism in the United States, I think, kind of got its roots back in the 1930s with the Frankfurt School importing its ideas into the United States, and Gramsci socialism, you know, coming into the United States in the 1920s, yeah, 1930s. And I think it gradually sort of infiltrated American universities, you know, from, say, the 1930s all the way to the current day. And so I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are on this anti-capitalist movement. How much of that is attributed to this growth in the cultural Marxist movement that kind of really started with Frankfurt School and even with Saul Alinsky and his publication of The Rules for Radicals in 1971 and so forth?
I think it's very important. And one way of classifying it would be the old Marxist argument was purely economics. I mean, some of it was politics, purely economics. We criticize capitalism because capitalists are exploiting laborers. That argument went away long ago when it was seen that the laborers, as you know, gained in productivity and real wages and living standards. And so the shift, you're absolutely true, the shift occurred after that. Well, if we can't find, they hated capitalism, right? They couldn't find antagonism really between capitalists, employers, and employees. So they shifted to other potential antagonisms. And we see them all today. I mean, it's men versus women. It's straight versus gay. It's black versus white. It's old versus young. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And they just wait for incidents to come up. So if it's Harvey Weinstein, they'll pound down the Me Too movement for 2 years. And then if George Floyd is killed, they'll pound on the blacks and whites are at each other. And the whole thing is capitalism, it leads to antagonism and leads to people at each other's throats. Let's just look for the different throats. That's all they do. And another, so I agree with you, Steve, that they have at the ready a whole litany of potential antagonisms that they just rotate through depending on what's in the headlines. And it's constant. It's just a constant barrage of, and the implication always, of course, is they won't say this. They won't say this is essential to to socialism or even to medievalism or to feudalism. Every antagonism, they'll say, is due to capitalism. And it's just a cover for the fact that they can't say it's an economic clash anymore. I think something that at TAS, Stephen Hick has written extensively and powerfully on the spread of postmodernism. So that is certainly anti-capitalist. So it isn't just, it's much worse than Marxism. Marxism claimed to have a different access to knowledge or the inevitability of scientific materialism and all that kind of stuff. Postmodernism is just anti-reason, totally anti-objectivity. anti-individualism, anti-seeing people as independent individuals. So that's going to be anti-capitalist as well. If that's what you're referring to, yes, that's been an undercurrent for a long time now, and it's emerging, well, all over the place with the gender stuff and the race stuff. The whole idea that if reason is out and people don't interact with each other on the basis of persuasion, it gets very concrete bound. So they start looking at pigmentation and genitals and stuff like that. When you think about it, it's like a very crude way of classifying people, because you're no longer dealing with them on an ideological or rational level. So you're just looking at these kind of crude, concrete bound aspects. Very anti-capitalist, yeah. Obviously.
Yeah.
Is that what you meant? Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And also, I think...
cultural part, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's actually been a long-term strategy of the Marxists to bring down the United States.
Yeah, you're a little quiet. I think I got muffled there. Can't hear you.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think it's been a long-term strategy of the Marxists, however long it takes, they've always wanted to bring down the United States. And I don't know if you're familiar with a Socialist Party presidential candidate in the 1950s, Norman Thomas. But anyway, he had a sort of famous quote that he made sometime in the 1950s. He said, that the socialists should not describe socialists
as liberal. Yeah, Steve, I don't think we. If you can hear us, Steve, I can't hear you. I don't know if others.
You break it up.
In and out. I would just to change the discussion a little bit. I would stress, as I have in the book, the disappointment I have with conservatives and libertarians not being pro-capitalist. So I think we can stipulate that the socialists and the postmodernists will be anti-capitalist. They always have been, but they're given such wide berth. It's a vacuum there, and it's so sad. I think one of the more interesting things that the Atlas Society does is it tries to reach out to and bolster the arguments and improve the arguments of conservatives and libertarians, because they really do need it. It's almost not even worth engaging with the socialists, because they're almost self-refuting. But it is somewhat of a head scratcher why by now the conservatives and libertarians would not realize that they need a really full-throated defense of the kind of things we believe in here: reason, individualism, egoism. They're very shy about it. They remain shy about it for various reasons. Even with the country going down, they don't seem to want to go there. David, Kelly, do you want to say more about that? It's really your strength more than mine, but that's something I'm sensing. I don't know if you have the same kind of disappointment with our, you know, fellow travelers.
Oh, I do. It's very deep and very longstanding. The conservatives are religious, you know, even if they're not officially believers or part of a church, they tend to accept the doctrines of religion, which includes altruism. So they, you know, they make some case often to the effect that, well, capitalism is really altruistic, because to be successful, you have to provide something that is valuable to other people. So your whole motive is altruistic. Yeah. And, you know, anyone who has ever done business or thinks about it knows that that's not the case. You are developing something that is good, and, you know, you have high standards, hopefully, of creating a great product at a competitive price, and you offer it. That's how capitalism works. But, you know, the motive is not just helping your neighbor. And libertarians are so afraid of egoism that they shy away from it and rely just on economics. I've seen this so many times over and over. Even at a relatively good place like Cato. But Richard, I also wanted to ask you, you've worked on Wall Street, and you were saying before that many of the people you worked with were very, you know, woke, well, at least left-wing, very socialist-oriented.
Yeah.
And there's a case that I put in information about a recent book by Stephen Sokoop called The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, that the elites in Wall Street are kind of buddy-buddy with the elites in academic life and the elites in Washington and gravitate left. So here's the question. To what extent over the decades you've been following the economy has the financial sector increased its share of the economy, giving them more wealth and influence as opposed to Main Street, so to speak?
Yeah, the phenomenon is called it actually has a name, David, financialization. And most economists criticize it. Certainly the socialists criticize it. And yes, you can measure, you know, to what extent an economy has a bigger financial sector, say, relative to the manufacturing sector or the service sector or agriculture. If you take something like Hong Kong, I mean, Hong Kong is 95% finance. The whole country is like a financial center, and it's one of the wealthiest countries, and still actually one of the freest countries on the planet. My theory on the financiers is, because I see this in university as well, it's not just the general public, but people who actually go into the field. This will sound crazy now, but they think it's parasitic. They don't actually think the financial sector is productive.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And now if you add to that the undeniable fact that they're some of the highest paid people in the country, they are enormously guilty. They feel enormously guilty about what they're doing. I don't know how many conversations I would have with a foreign exchange trader or an investment banker, and we would have discussions, and they would say something like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Not that they weren't skilled. They were highly skilled. No, they meant something like, I have no idea what I'm contributing to the economy. I'm just trading stocks here. I'm just shuffling paper. I'm just doing mergers and acquisitions. You know, I'm moving freight from one bucket to another. There was all this discussion. And of course, they'd been taught that in business school. The problem is that's how it's taught in economics. It's not taught as a productive sector. I actually think, this will sound crazy to most people, I think the financial sector is more productive than the other sectors. I wouldn't go overboard on that, but I think of the financial sector as the brains of the economy. They're deciding where capital is invested and allocated. Yeah. So they have to figure out what every other industry is doing. They have to figure out, that's why they have analysts on Wall Street. You know this, David, all your years writing for Barron's. Those people basically have to decide what is the great new product coming. They have to judge management. They have to judge this industry's rising, this industry's falling. It's an enormously difficult and complex thing to do. And now if you're just like in the manufacturing sector and you're in the steel business, I'm not saying it's not difficult, you know, to be a steel executive, but you're basically focused on steel. You know, whereas the investment banker is focused on steel and aluminum and agriculture. So it's really sad because I think the combination of them thinking, I don't think I'm productive, yet I'm making a lot of money. I got to, every growing year, I got to give something back to the community because I feel like I stole something from the community. Or, this is the Goldman Sachs theory, I need to go into public service. I need to, I'll spend the first half of my life accumulating massive money, but then I'll work for the Treasury. So the turnstiles between Wall Street and the Treasury Department or the Fed or that kind of thing, much of it is motivated by their view of, well, I'm 45 now and I'm a multimillionaire, time to work at the U.S. Treasury and, you know, adopt a graduated income tax or something on these people that I don't trust, my former colleagues, all that kind of stuff. It's really terrible. It's really sad.
Yeah, Richard, as an expert in this field, I just have one follow-up question, and I'll mute. I was once talking to a very successful investor, and so I asked him, you know, what What is the productive function performed by the financial industry? And he said this guy must have been, he was an objectivist, I know. So he thought conceptually. He said two things. One is it allocates capital on a rational basis. And the other is it allows for people to offload risk.
Yeah, that's okay. That's not a bad answer.
Yeah, so both of which seem to me, you know, along the lines of what you were saying, hugely, hugely productive.
Another way of interpreting this would be the residue and leftover of the labor theory of value. It's hard to believe that that's still around. But from the time of Adam Smith and Marx, the view was there's manual labor, there's skilled labor, and there's cerebral or mental labor. And their view was, if you're working with your hands, if you're getting your hands dirty and calloused, if you're digging, if you're, you know, agriculture or mining, digging stuff out of the ground, that's real production. Or if you're on an assembly line, you know, but that's real. But if you're in a white collar, sitting in an office, having a meeting with someone, what the hell is that? That's their view. The whole pyramid of ability that she wrote about in Atlas, you know, that the people at the top actually contribute more than the people at the bottom, that they're rarefied air, that one of the reasons they get paid so well is not only are they more productive as intellects and creative people and entrepreneurs and managers and strategists who see further than the janitor does, that whole thing is not really understood. And that's another thing that would be biased against the financier, right? Everybody knows what the farmer does. Plants seeds and harvests. Then to ask them what an investment banker does, I don't know, rips people off. They have no clue of what, I would say even scientists and engineers, they would say, I have no idea what they're doing, but I know they're brainiacs. Other than that, they can't really explain it. So I don't know, back to this idea that if you don't understand something, you fear it a little bit. So, But the sad thing is to see people in the field itself swallow these premises. That's what's really, it's not just outsiders who are saying, I have no idea what Wall Street's doing, therefore it's probably parasitic. It's the Wall Streeters themselves who feel that way. Really not all, not all.
Ayn Rand made people feel better about themselves.
Richard, I have a comment about the financial sector. You're talking about the financial sector.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting about the financial sector is how heavily regulated. Can you hear me?
You're very muffled again, Steve. Okay. You're okay. Good for a second, then it got muffled.
Okay, I'll try again. What's interesting about the financial sector is how heavily regulated it is. And I think because of the, you know, the heavy regulation, the biggest banks have gotten bigger and more profitable, while the small community banks really have not grown and, you know, are basically kind of flatlined. And I think it's because of how heavily regulated the financial sector is, because the biggest players have the resources, you know, to pay for the all the attorneys and accountants that know how to deal with all the compliance and regulation versus like the small community banks.
I think it's part of, Steve, I think it's part of the same theme of if government really wants to control and be fascistic, it needs big banks who are obeying them. But they don't really care about the small banks for that reason. So I think it's just another example of if we're moving in a fascist direction, don't be surprised that bigness, although rhetorically denounced, the more they rhetorically denounce big business, the more they're in the pockets of big business. What I just said, though, sounds something like Bernie Sanders would say. It sounds like I'm a socialist, notice, by saying something like that. But Bernie Sanders wasn't against the bank bailouts and Barack Obama wasn't there. I think they recognize that as the state becomes more and more burdensome, and by the way, as it becomes fiscally profligate, it's just like massive chronic deficit spending. It's going to want to take over the financial sector. It has to. One of the reasons the Federal Reserve got rid of the gold standard 100 years ago is the Federal Reserve was created not to fix the monetary system and not to ensure safe and sound banking, but to help the government finance itself. Well, now fast forward 100 years from now, and the government is completely out of control in terms of trying to finance itself. So the Fed has become a whore to the Treasury needs. You know, in the 90s, we used to talk about central bank independence. The central banks were supposed to be diminished down to don't touch anything at the Treasury. Independence meant don't be political. The central bank should be off there just ensuring that the value of currency was stable. Now central banks are totally every day helping government issue its bonds, monetize its bonds, keep its bond yields down to zero so it can afford all this stuff. I mean, think of it, they're totally, the central banks have been totally turned into political entities. And Wall Street is just something, Wall Street just becomes something that the central banks need to dump all these bonds into. So it co-opts, I think Mises actually said this amazingly in the 60s. Mises said, if we keep going in this direction, the banks will become ipso facto subsidiaries of the Treasury Department.
Yes.
Remarkably prescient.
Yes. Yeah. Just one final point on the big banks, you know, the Dodd-Frank Act, the massive Dodd-Frank Act, over 2,000 pages. The intent, supposed intent of the Dodd-Frank Act was to end too big to fail. But yeah. Yet the largest banks are now much, much bigger today than they were with the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act.
Yeah.
And much more powerful. So.
And the too big to fail doctrine goes all the way back to 1982. So this has been going on for a while now.
Yeah.
So Abby, shall we wrap up?
Yeah, I was gonna say we're coming up to time, but does anybody have like any final pressing questions before we go? Hit our time here. Pretty on the nose this time. Anybody? Well, I want to, you know, thank Dr. Salzman for presenting his new book. I'll be sending a recording of this out, and if you guys want to get a copy of the book, I will send links to affiliate links to Amazon to get copies of the book if you don't already have that one. And you can get it on Kindle. I believe there is a Kindle version now. And so I will send that link as well. And then share with your friends. And I think that's what we're all here to do, is to, you know, talk about these topics so that we can talk about them with the people who don't see eye to eye with us, hopefully. Maybe not the really crazy ones that they won't talk to you, but, you know. People always say don't argue with people who don't who aren't really there to listen, but other than that, I think we're here to have those conversations. So any final comments from you, Dr. Salzman?
Well, I just encourage people to read the book and tell others about it, and if you want, write a review, a brief review at Amazon. The book is really, the sales are going up, it's surprising to me, and the reviews are, there are reviews we're working on being done in various journals and things. That's nice. I continue to be on an active book tour, if you want to call it that. And it's been fun. It's been exciting because the different venues ask different things, really. But Abby, I wanted to thank you for organizing this and quarterbacking it all. I thank you very much. And everyone who participated tonight, tell all your friends about the book. Thank you.
Yes, for sure. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Abby. Thanks, Richard.
Of course. Have a great rest of your night, everyone.
Take care. Thank you.